So I get in the driver's seat and we take off. We're on the other routes for the day. In the same hole and the same route we were blown up that morning, the enemy places a bigger, stronger IED directly in that hole. Come to find out, that was actually the sole purpose of the first blast. It really wasn't to do any real damage necessarily. They were testing different ways to blow us up. And so they put a 200-pound directional charge IED in the hole. They put an artillery round on top. They buried it, made it look like vehicles were driving over it while we were gone. And the guy with the detonator waited behind a tree for any unit to return. Little did he know, it was actually going to be my unit.
Hey guys, check out the 2023 Street Cop Conference, April 23rd through the 28th, Gaylord Convention Center. It's going to be the event of the year. Keynote speakers include Rob O'Neill, the guy who killed Bin Laden, Kyle Carpenter, the youngest living Medal of Honor recipient, Navy SEAL Jason Redman, Fox News host Tommy Lahren, Marine Corps Special Forces and Leadership Coach Cody Alford, Sheriff Wayne Ivey, Sheriff David Clark, and Sheriff Mark Lamb. It's going to be one hell of an event. And on top of that, we have all of our instructors and additional instructors from other companies going to be at the event, giving you everything they know for you to have a successful career and get the results you want to get in the field as a police officer. On top of attending the event, you'll get face-to-face time with every instructor attending the event, and all the keynote speakers will spend time with you. We got special events all week, giveaways, nightlife. It's going to be really, really worth your time, energy, and effort. I promise you, you will not regret it for a second. To register for the conference, check out streetcop.com, click conference, and everything you need will be there on the homepage. If you are looking for a room, just click book a room. The block has been sold out at the Gaylord Opryland Convention Center, but there are many hotels nearby within a walking distance of the event. You don't want to miss out on this opportunity. We will see you there.
You trying to be a street cop?
Let's just fucking rock and roll. Tell people who JP Lane is.
I'm JP Lane, and I was served in the United States Army, and obviously during my deployment to Afghanistan, I ended up having such a good time. I had a blast, and it ended up taking both my legs, definitely pun intended. But I'm the type of person that likes to see the positive in any negative. So here we are today, 12 years later, and enjoying life.
Well, it's a real positive way to look at it. Let's go back to where you grew up, who you are, how'd you get involved in the Army? What were your hopes, dreams, and aspirations post-Army that kind of got disrupted by you losing both limbs?
Yeah, so the crazy thing was 9/11 was the whole kickoff of the idea that was put into my mind and heart for serving and joining the military. But in that moment in 9/11, I was only in eighth grade language arts class. So I ended up having my teacher leave the room, come back and bring a TV on wheels, plugged it in. We were expecting movie day. However, that was not the case that time. And she turns on the news and we actually watched the towers fall. In that moment, I knew that I wanted to serve and protect the United States against moments like that ever happening again. So obviously I had to wait till after eighth grade because only the Marines accept eighth graders. So after high school, I graduated and I was reminded of that idea of joining the military. Now, the funny part is actually the fact that my dad was Air Force. So he had no clue I went to the recruiter's office, signed up for the Army, and chose the most dangerous job at that time. And it was quite an interesting conversation, to say the least, when I went back home and said, hey, by the way, I joined the military, didn't even choose the Air Force, and I had the most dangerous job. He didn't talk to me for like a week. So
When he did talk to you, what did he say?
When he did, he was like, why did you choose the Army? Because he was like, why didn't you go Air Force? It's so much nicer. Well, obviously, everyone is biased, right? But at the same time, I wanted to be on ground in front at the very beginning of all missions and protect those who I possibly could. So that's what I decided to do, was search for IEDs and clear routes and make sure everyone got home safe.
Damn. I don't think people really know. Well, some of us do, but I think we've lost a lot of context of what 9/11 meant to those of us who are old enough to remember it. And, you know, you
it's a long time ago. So people who are 23, 21, 22, 25, they don't recall it like most of us recall it. You were in eighth grade. I was 19 at the time. I was turning 20 that year, and I was going to the police academy. October 7th was my start date. October 7th, October 9th, something like that. And I was delivering pizza that morning, and I watched the towers fall from Route 1 southbound in Woodbridge Township, actually the Avenel section of our town. And people just, I don't think if you lived it, you could understand what JP's saying. And we hear this all the time from everybody who's on here. Even Mateus, when he was on, said the same exact thing. So did Nick Lavery. So did everybody. The motivation to join the military was 9/11. That's how profound that event was that occurred, that it literally influenced you for 4 or 5 years to stay focused on what was important to you. And I think everybody, I remember my dad coming to me, I talked about this on the podcast, and he's like, hey, you know, can I talk to you? My father never talked to me, right? Like, just like, not that he was, we just not like this. He was just not the type of father. You know, he was just not the type of guy to sit down and have a heart to heart. Wasn't that type of dad. And he's like, you thinking about joining the military? I go, no. He goes, all right. I said, why'd you ask me that? He goes, well, you know, a lot of the guys I work with, the kids are joining the military. He goes, I don't want you. I sit down, I'm in the police academy. Like, I start in like 2 weeks. I'm not going to go to the military. I've already started the police academy. You know, I'll be the protector on the home front. I don't know what to tell you, but I'm not going. He's like, all right, just making sure. And if you think about joining, just let me know. All right. And I'm like, you got it. No problem. And that was the whole conversation my father had. I can't imagine you're telling your father, I'm going to go out and search for IEDs. My father's like terrified. He's not an emotional man. Maybe it was emotional. Who knows? And, you know, I can imagine what your father's going through in his mind. Like, Jesus Christ, JP, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, well, actually, I didn't tell him 100% what my job was. So I just told him I had a pretty dangerous job. I didn't tell him exactly what I was doing until I deployed to Afghanistan in 2010.
And what did he say then?
Well, he definitely prayed over me before I left for my deployment, and he trusted that I was well trained and understood my job, which I was very well trained in every task and drill and everything the military, the Army taught me. So we maintained focus throughout the entire year. And to be honest, my unit came back home from that deployment as the number one combat engineer unit in the entire U.S. Army because we kicked butt over there. So that was an honor to wake up and hear the good news about my unit and how well we did. So it was awesome. But yeah, I'll never forget deploying, though. That was definitely life-changing. In 2010, they called my unit to deploy over to Afghanistan. And for those who don't know how route clearance or what route clearance even is, I literally would go get into a convoy every single morning, go out and search for homemade explosive devices that are made by the enemy. They would place them in the roads. And for anyone else to go and do their mission safely, for the civilians over there to just live semi-normal lives and try to do their daily routine, those roads had to be cleared of IED threats, because otherwise they were just blowing people up left and right. And that was our job, to go out every day, every morning. They give us a list of routes and we would go clear them, protecting the roads for everyone else to go safe.
So I guess the elephant in the room, how did this happen?
So I was blown up three total times, three different missions, three different days. And the last one ends up getting me. So
this let's go back. Cause nobody knew that you got blown up three fucking times. I know you hauled all this shit back. We'd have a lot of time at SHOT Show to chop it off. Let's go back to the first time you got blown up and we'll start there.
The first time I was blown up, I was actually sitting in the driver's seat that day, which is not common for me. I was a gunner for most of my missions. So I'm sitting in the driver's seat and we're rolling down the route. And all of a sudden my truck blows up, flies up into the air, slams back down, missing tires and pieces and everything. And I'm not going to lie, I tell people this all the time. I'm the type of person that really loves roller coasters. So when I was blown up, before the dust even settled, I'm sitting there in the driver's seat and I look at my truck commander in the passenger seat and I was like, let's do that again. which he was like, no, absolutely not. I do not want to get blown up. He did not like that feeling whatsoever. But for me, I actually already understood that I didn't really care how big the bomb was. I didn't care that it totaled the truck on the outside. It didn't get through the truck, and it didn't hurt my battle buddies in the truck. So I actually was just enjoying the moment. I had, like, if it was a roller coaster, per se. So same thing, second, another mission, second IED blast that I was in. The truck flies up into the air, slams back down, missing tires and pieces and everything. And again, everything was fine. And when soldiers, when units are overseas deployed to a war zone, and we're the only ones doing all the damage, kicking butt, and none of us are getting hurt, I'm not going to lie, some mindsets of invincibility kind of kick in, you know? And we think, oh, we're kind of all that, nobody can touch us. And March 26, 2011 was a day I'll never forget, because my best friend, Justin Ross, was shot and killed by a sniper.
Damn.
And that day was the most devastating day of my entire deployment, I would say, because I'll never forget coming back from mission, all of my company in formation in the motor pool, which is where they had all the trucks and stuff on our base. And we're all sitting in formation. And never in my entire life did I think I would see what I saw that day. And looking at Justin Ross's boots, rifle, and helmet stacked up. We've all seen that picture before, the boots, rifle, and helmet, the soldier's cross, the battle cross. It has a couple names for it, but at the end of the day, I never thought I would see his gear standing in front of me, set up, representing the fact that he is no longer with us. And they put a picture of him in front. And after formation was done, after we paid our honor and respects to his sacrifice, I walked right up to his gear and dropped to my knees and bawled my eyes out for what literally felt like eternity. And I will never forget that day.
Let's go back a little bit. How did he get shot by a sniper? How did that happen? Did you witness it? Were you hearing the radio communications? What was going on there? How did that incident unfold?
So Justin was out with two other guys. They were out in the field clearing an area that they needed to clear. And they did everything that they needed to. They were putting out some, to say the least, because not necessarily to talk about tech, but they were putting out some new tech out there to help with our missions. And as they were walking back, they didn't know that further away in the field, there was a sniper in a hidden position. And so the sniper shot as one of our guys was bending over to literally tie his shoelace, that his boot shoelace came undone. And then the sniper adjusted and directly hit straight through the... hit straight through the helmet, directly in the head. And Justin dropped, obviously. They didn't know where it was coming from, what had happened. They immediately, a couple of the soldiers got out, immediately grabbed Ross and brought him into the trucks, and they got back to the base. And that was literally the day that I changed my mind on the MOS, which is the job in the military that I wanted to do. I no longer wanted to do route clearance. I actually had so much anger and hate, revenge, every negative thought you could possibly imagine. And I was going to leave that deployment, go become special forces sniper, go back to all the deployments I possibly could, and hunt until I was hunted, because that's how much anger and frustration I had. And I knew that a lot of soldiers will come home from seeing tragedy like this and going through such difficulty in a war zone, and that will weigh on our shoulders. They call it PTSD. It'll haunt us. It's supposed to apparently haunt us for the rest of our lives. And I knew that there was one way I wouldn't come home with any of those negative thoughts. And to get directly into it, July 2nd, 2011, that moment ends up happening where I was blown up my third and final time and changed my life forever.
So do you find that the incident where you were blown up, and we'll get into more details about that, and you subsequently lost both your legs, became a double amputee, was that like some kind of poetic thing you think in your mind of how you solidified your PTSD?
I don't know if it was necessarily that. I mean, a very offset, my, like not offset, but maybe like a very distant thought of that could definitely be correct. I think it was more that I do have faith. I do believe that God is real. And so the fact that he was protecting me and he did not want me to come home with that negativity, because I hated the world at that point. And I was so frustrated and angry and had revenge and everything negative possibly running through my mind. And it was the craziest thing, but I know that everything happened for a reason, because the day I was blown up was actually my day off. Like, I shouldn't have even been on mission. So knowing that I shouldn't have been on mission, it was my day off. And then I switched spots with my driver that day. So literally we get into formation, we're in the convoy, and we go out July 2nd, 2011. And this was a different mission too. That's why I got woken up that morning, and the whole tent was asked, hey, who wants to go out on mission? We actually need more troops because it's a special mission. What do I mean by that? For those who don't know how route clearance missions operate, they give us a list of routes. We clear them one at a time, and then we go back to the base. But this day, they asked us to clear the most dangerous route, not just once, but twice. Once in the morning, followed by the rest of our routes for the day, and then once in the afternoon. So that's our job, so we headed out. We get onto the most dangerous route for the first time of the day, called Route Red Stripe at the time. And as soon as we get out onto Route Red Stripe, the truck in front of me gets hit immediately. Nobody got hurt, but everyone had to go back to the base, and we actually had to call back for a new truck, a new crew, and a hauler to come pick up the total truck so we can continue mission, right? So as this was happening, that's when the exchange happened. My driver mics up and says, hey, Lane, you mind if I spend time so I could get my 50 cal medal, my time under the 50 cal? I was like, yeah, that's fine, bro. We're like 30 days from going home, so I don't mind driving the rest of the mission. So I get in the driver's seat and we take off. We're on the other routes for the day. In the same hole and the same route we were blown up that morning, the enemy places a bigger, stronger IED directly in that hole. Come to find out, that was actually the sole purpose of the first blast. It really wasn't to do any real damage necessarily. They were testing different ways to blow us up. And so they put a 200-pound directional charge IED in the hole. They put an artillery round on top. They buried it, made it look like vehicles were driving over it while we were gone. And the guy with the detonator waited behind a tree for any unit to return. Little did he know, it was actually going to be my unit. So we're done clearing the other routes. We get back out onto Route Red Stripe for the second and final time of the day. Super pumped, excited that we're almost done. We can head back to the base and get some chow, hit the gym, do all that stuff that we normally do after mission. And there's a truck that's normally in the front of our convoy called a Husky. And it has a panel system on the front that scans underground and tells us what's going on. It can literally help us find a possible IED threat. Well, the density of the dirt changed because that hole was no longer compact dirt. It was loose. So it didn't show up properly what was going on the driver's screen. And together as a unit, we just assumed, okay, well, maybe the civilians put the dirt back in the hole so they could drive and continue their daily routines, and we didn't check it. And every truck in my convoy driving over 5 miles an hour, and as soon as my truck, which I was the last vehicle in the convoy that day, as soon as we get on top of the 200-pound IED, the guy presses the detonator, turning my RG-31, which is the type of truck I was in, into a half a truck. No more engine, no more front tires. And it was the first RG-31 in history to actually be penetrated by an IED. They finally figured out how to get through our trucks, which are normally V-hulls. And most people understand that V-haul trucks for the military, that allows the blast to go up and away from the vehicle. But this time they got through. And that's immediately when my truck flew up into the air and actually slammed down on the passenger side, causing even more injury and damage to my body than I would have anticipated at all.
All right. We know that we're going to now hear a story about, from this point forward, the injuries you sustained. But what happened to the guy who was manning the 50 caliber up top?
Not a scratch.
Wow. Just the two of you in the truck?
No, my truck commander was in the passenger seat. He actually ended up breaking his right leg, but healing up. And I'm glad both of them didn't get severely injured. I took the brunt of the IED blast directly under me. So.
And do you remember any of it?
I would take that blast a million times over for every single person here.
You know, it's crazy. When I met you at SHOT Show, kind of a fluke thing, I was walking around promoting our conference, and I met the guy from Under Armour. I'm assuming you have some kind of deal with Under Armour.
That is definitely the goal. Yeah, they're a sponsor, and we're talking about bigger things together, which is super cool. They're an awesome group.
Well, he said, you got to meet this guy. So he brings me around the back, and then I said to you, hey, man, I don't know what happened, whatever it is. Thank you for your service. And you said to me, basically what you just said now is, I'm perfectly okay with what happened. I believed in what I was doing. And I would do it again if I had to.
My number one response, I appreciate every single person that thanks me and my brothers and sisters in arms for our service and sacrifice. But when someone tells me that, I will always tell them you're worth it. So.
Cool shit. How did you get to a place like that mentally?
A lot of hell and a whole lot more faith. So giving me the strength to get through was pretty devastating, because when I was blown up, obviously I went through a lot of injuries, which we'll probably talk about in a second. But just to give a little tidbit of what I went through, I almost took my life 12 separate times, and I wanted to end it. I absolutely hated the guy I would see in the mirror, and I did not want to be him anymore. So I attempted suicide 12 separate times, and nobody even knew, because I was that good at putting on a smile.
Before we get into that, which is something I definitely want to explore, do you remember anything about the blast, or did it just knock you completely unconscious?
I remember every single detail.
And so tell us about it.
Yeah, I can dream about it every day and it doesn't even bug me. But literally, I'll never forget when the truck went up, flew up into the air and slammed down. I didn't know at that moment that my body was completely destroyed. So just to give you an idea of it, all the injuries, both my legs were amputated, which I actually tell people is a blessing in disguise. And they're like, that's nuts. Why would you say that's a good thing? But my soldiers actually found my right foot and boot melted to the floorboard of my truck. So if I wasn't amputated immediately, I would have been melted to the floorboard of my truck. And also when the truck flew onto the passenger side, aside from my left femur snapping half, it actually snapped my pelvis in half and dislocated my spine from my pelvis completely.
Whoa.
Pretty much turning me into a piece of spaghetti. Also, my right arm snapped in half at a 90 degree angle. And my face hit the steering wheel, knocked out my four front teeth, which I didn't really feel at the time. Because during this moment, my adrenaline is pumping so hard, I literally did not feel any pain. and I didn't feel any injury that I actually sustained in that moment. On top of that, the doctor said that my brain, which I actually have pictures of my truck, it shattered the windshield of my vehicle, and that's 4 inches thick of bulletproof glass, and it flattened my my brain to the size of a pancake, swelled right back up and pressed against my skull, causing a traumatic brain injury, and I had no idea. And then on top of that, my heart and my left lung were the only things that survived the blast, because the flying pieces of metal that went through actually cut up everything else inside. And that was, you'd think that'd be pretty bad and pretty hard to do anything with all of that damage. But again, I didn't feel anything in the moment. And since I was still awake, I was still understanding what was going on. I realized that my entire body, practically with all my armor and all my gear, was laying on my passenger, my truck commander, suffocating him, which I heard him yelling, "Hey, Lane, get off me, I can't breathe." And so I had to use my right broken arm in half. I pushed off of him using his seat with my broken arm, and I pulled myself up with my left arm to try and hold myself, my body off of him so that I wouldn't suffocate him. And while I was doing that, I looked down at my legs, and I didn't see any damage, but all I saw was blood all the way down my pants, my uniform. And so I knew I was messed up. I just didn't really know how bad. And my soldiers stated to me, they actually mentioned that the moment they climbed up onto the truck, my door, thankfully, was actually blown off as well. So my soldiers were able to just lean in and grab me and pull me out of the truck. And that's when the blood loss caused me to actually pass out right then and there. So they safely got me down onto the ground. And my medic, who is super awesome, he got right to work, put tourniquets on all of my limbs and everything, even on my neck. No, I'm just kidding. And he put 6 IV bags into my body, pumped 6 IV bags into my body before the bird even landed. And that helped the process of keeping me alive. But I will never forget my medic telling me, "I saw your eyes roll to the back of your head, and we thought you died right there the moment we put you on the bird."
Wow. So where do you go from there?
So they flew me out to the hospital in Kandahar, where they continued to operate on me. And to be honest, this is how well-trained our medical staff is in the military. Normally in this situation, and even in my situation, soldiers are back in the United States in 72 hours after being taken care of, making sure they're stable, and they're shipped out to the best facility in the United States to be taken care of. But my body was having such a hard time staying alive. I actually died twice on the operating table. And so that being said, it took them almost a week, almost 2 weeks, I mean, to actually get me stable enough just to make the trip back to the United States safely. Then from there, they got me to Walter Reed, which I actually was there for a long time. I was in a coma for a month and a half, and I woke up after that coma in Walter Reed, not necessarily understanding what was going on. And even to the extent of what necessarily happened. But I'll never forget one of the things my dad did, because when I was in a coma, the doctors were already preparing him for the worst. I say that because the first 2 weeks I was in a coma, it was actually medically induced. So they were operating on me, making sure they were putting me back together properly. And then they took me off of the medically induced coma, and they expected for me to wake up. However, I did not for an entire month after that. So they were actually warning my family, like, "Hey, we don't know why he's not waking up. He might stay in a coma state for ever potentially, because his body may have just completely shut down and we don't know. We want to prepare you. And on top of that, if he does wake up from his coma, what happened to his brain was extremely devastating, and he'll most likely have brain damage for the rest of his life." So the day I woke up from my coma, my dad immediately wanted to find out. Everybody, the nurses and doctors, my family members, they were all in the room. And my dad writes on a sticky note, being prior Air Force, pretty smart dude. He wanted to find out if I had a brain, any sort of brain damage. He writes on the sticky note, "Can you read this?" And everyone watching, he shows me the sticky note. I could barely move. I could not talk because I had a tracheotomy in my throat and tubes hooked up to everywhere pretty much. And all I could do was nod my head yes.
That's amazing, dude. That is amazing. Do you remember what your father reacted like when you nod your head yes?
Everybody cried.
Fuck, almost had me crying right now, dude.
Everybody cried. Like, not only were they just excited and happy that I woke up from my coma, they were more excited because I was able to read those four simple words. They would know that at least I'd be smarter than my siblings, which was nice.
Did your father happen to save that sticky note?
I have that sticky note. Yeah, it's in my house, dude, in a shadow box with a lot of memories and different things from my time in the hospital.
Yeah, it's fucking amazing, dude. I think you need to take that sticky note and do something good with that. I think you need to maybe write the excerpt of what you just told me. And, you know, Jay Redmond?
That sounds familiar, yeah.
Okay, so he's a Navy SEAL. He spent a lot of time in Walter Reed as well. He was shot 11 or 12 times. Jay's actually speaking at our conference. And my suggestion is to go onto YouTube and watch Jason Redmond, Hard Times. But he was in Walter Reed as well. And he wrote this thing to the hospital staff. I mean, you hear Jay's story, it's pretty wild. Just as wild as your story. His whole face reconstructed. You know, he was really, he took rounds through the side of his skull. Like really insane stuff. Jay's a great guy. I'm so glad that I'm friends with him now too. Like, we text, we chop it up. But there's something he wrote. It's on a red piece of construction paper, and it had to do with maybe a page of hope. And it was, he was no longer listening to anybody. What they told him he was going to be, they would decide what he was going to be. And it hangs at Walter Reed. My suggestion is maybe to make something up and donate your note to Walter Reed, so it hangs in the hallway there. It's a really fucking cool story.
That would be cool.
I think you should do that, man. I'm actually going to break your fucking balls until you do it.
I'll never forget, though. I got to tell you this real quick story, that when I was in the hospital bed, still like all shot up with painkillers and everything like that, tubes still hooked up and everything, one of the other moments my dad reminds me about constant, like over and over, is the fact that he knew I was okay as well because of one action with a general who had come into my room. And the first thing the general did, which is not common, if you know anything about the military or rank systems at all, generals don't salute anybody who's enlisted. They don't salute anybody that's lower ranking for the most part. Generals get saluted too. He walks in the room and he salutes me laying there in bed. And my right arm was completely broken and still trying to heal. But I knew that I needed to salute to this man because I saw his rank, and I saluted with my left hand, which is not correct. But I still did what I remembered I needed to do to a general, right, in regards to saluting. And they were just like blown away, the fact that I knew I had to do that. After being blown up and going through everything, I'm still like, yes, sir. So, yeah, it was crazy, but it was amazing. I had my ups and downs, obviously, in those hospital rooms that I was in. And even though those moments were positive for my family to see, I didn't have any positive moments necessarily for a very long time, until this gentleman and his wife, and I say gentleman kindly because this dude was ancient. I'm pretty sure he got off of Noah's Ark. That's how old he was. But he would come around every week with his wife and give cookies to all the warriors in the hospital rooms. And finally, one day I had enough of his nonsense. And I was like, look, dude, stop telling me I'm going to be okay, because you're going around telling me and all these warriors we're going to be fine. You have no idea how I feel. And this old fart leans over, pulls up one of his pant legs, and this dude's an amputee too. I'm like, all right, if this zombie looking old man who's out here using a prosthetic, walking around a million miles a day, can do this, I have no excuses. So I need to get myself straight and focus on getting back on my feet, pun intended, I guess, and get out there and continue living life. So yeah, that inspired the heck out of me.
You know anything else about that guy at all? Have you learned about his story?
Nope. Didn't know his name. Didn't get any contact information. I don't even know if he still walks around Walter Reed Hospital or not with his wife giving cookies. No idea. But I'm very grateful for that one moment, because for a guy with short-term memory loss issues, I will never forget that.
You know, it's crazy, man. He thought the cookies were the gesture, but it wasn't the cookies that was the gesture. Yeah. And it just goes to show you what you can do to impact somebody's life, you know, essentially giving you hope by handing out cookies. There should be a book on, the title should be Handing Out Cookies. That's how I think about it. Dude, it's a fucking, I wonder who that guy is. Maybe tell your wife to write these notes down in case your short-term memory doesn't remember this, but maybe you guys should try to find out who that is. I'd love to hear. If you ever find out, he's got to come back on and tell me who he was. They got to know who he is. Hold on to Walter Reed.
There's two people I would like to find. That's one of them. If I could ever find that man, if he's still with us today, I would like to shake his hand. Number two, actually three people. I lied. Number two, my drill sergeant from basic training at Fort Leonard Wood, Drill Sergeant Hall. I will never forget that dude. He pushed me to be the strongest person because I was one of the shortest, but he was like, it doesn't matter how tall you are. And to this day, I still hold the record as the fastest soldier in my unit that I deployed with in Afghanistan for the 2 mile run at 10:40. I don't even got legs. I tease them all the time, but it's because of Drill Sergeant Hall, who pushed me constantly during basic training to be the best person and soldier I possibly could be. And then number three, my recruiter. I think that would be hilarious. Who, the guy who said, yeah, you should be a combat engineer. It'll be a blast. It's all good. I think it would be hilarious if he met me. Be like, hey, you didn't tell me exactly what kind of blast it was going to be. Now look at me. It would be a very fun conversation.
You got to reach out to these people, dude. Does he know? Is he aware of your situation?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think so. Because I've had people reach out to me, but I haven't had anybody like tell me, hey, I was the one who recruited you in Green Bay, Wisconsin. But yeah, maybe one day we'll find him. Who knows? That'd be awesome, though.
I'd love to hear about the guy who brought the cookies. Like, I'd love to watch you speak to him and what it meant. And you said he was old, so he might be dead.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you never know. That was 12 years ago, like 11 and a half years ago. That was a long time, and he was already old then. I hope he's around. That'd be cool if I could meet him, but maybe we'll have to give a call out to Walter Reed and see what's up, see if there's still an old fart with his wife walking around giving cookies.
Maybe you could find out what his story was and why he did it. Maybe there's this cool, like in my mind, Netflix documentary of, you know, handing out cookies and what it meant, and you sit down and
I'll tell you one thing, that scene will definitely, God willing, if I ever get a movie with my story told, that scene will definitely be in the opening part of the movie where he's walking around giving cookies out and he walks into my room and we have that exchange, because little did I know that that was one of the big things that helped push me to move forward. So
I imagine this documentary of like every single person that he impacted telling the story about this guy and who he was. Dude, that's cool shit, man. That's $1 million idea right there. So if Netflix, you're listening, I'll take some royalties on that shit. Yeah. And
15.5%.
Yeah, JP Lane needs to fucking get some royalties as well. I'll probably just redonate them all because
there you go.
That's typically what I do when I get any kind of royalties.
That's funny. I always joke around and tell people that if I ever get royalties for anything, I always add 0.5% in honor of my half.
That's pretty funny. You know, you said that you were the shortest guy in boot camp, and I think about, like, you're definitely the shortest guy now. When you when you got prosthetic limbs, did you ever like ask, like, hey, you know, I've always wanted to be 6 foot tall. Can you pack me up a little bit,
bro? So they literally told me that I can change my height and I can increase in height every 2 years. So every year I can increase 2 inches in height. So I was 5'6". Right now I am 5'7", and I always wanted to be 5'7". I'm not giving that inch back. Like, this is the, I am at the height I want to be forever. And
we're going to go to 6 foot, dude. 6 foot's good, bro. I'm telling you, I'm living up here. It's good. You should come up.
I will definitely, if I need to. So I always tell Crystal, my wife, that look, if we're having hard times and you want to cheat on me with a new man, just tell me, I'll go get a few inches, be up taller than like 6 foot, 6'1", whatever. And I'll be a new man. And then there, you don't have to cheat on me. I can be the new man you want anytime. It's pretty nice.
I mean, I gotta get. I don't think she's going anywhere. The way she looks at you, dude, I saw she's got stars in her eyes when she sees you. Big hearts, and you're a handsome motherfucker. So you're hard. Google JP Lane. He's got the.
That's what it is. It's all the legs. That's what.
Oh, dude, those are cool fucking legs right there.
Oh, they're sick. I'm very grateful. Really, my wife wants me to take my leg off and show you guys. She crazy. She crazy, man. That's one of them, right there.
Sweet.
This leg right here. Do you guess how much this thing is?
Bro, I'm going to guess, and I, now that you've prefaced it a little bit, I'm going to guess higher than I would originally guessed. I'm going to go $25,000 for that leg.
Keep going.
50?
$65,000.
Wow. For one leg?
For one leg. And this one, that one that I just showed y'all, doesn't even have a computer system. My left leg, which is a lot more difficult to take off, but ultimately this thing right here, there's a computer system under this protection cover here. And that is a $250,000 leg.
Your leg is 250?
Yeah.
Who paid for that?
Thankfully not me, because I would be not in prosthetics. I would definitely be in the cheaper $1,000 wheelchair with spinners. That's what I would be doing. But thankfully, the VA definitely hooked me up. And because of the VA, it's actually the taxpayer. So thank you. You all are awesome because you actually helped put me back on my feet.
Boy, I'm thankful that you got fucking legs. And I hope that I continue to pay my tax dollars and some of that gets allocated to a guy like you.
That's awesome. Well, I appreciate that a lot. And I know a lot of our brothers and sisters in arms appreciate it too. Because, yeah, they're expensive, but they give us so much freedom. Like, people don't even know. Just the loss of an ankle is insane. Like, when you get that movement back, when you get the ability to walk back, to run, you see my blades on the couch here. We're in the motorhome today. But I also have another pair of prosthetics over behind the computer that y'all can't see that are wakeboarding / snowboarding prosthetics. And they're sitting in my wakeboard right now. Like, you guys have no idea that when I get to run again, when I get to wakeboard again, that is so amazing that I have that ability. And it's all because the people that not only cared enough to be like, hey, we should design some legs so these people who are amputees can actually get up and walk again, get up and run again, get up and live life again. Like, seriously, I'm so grateful. I don't take anything for granted, especially prosthetics. Because they are painful, I'll be completely honest. They're sexy as hell, but they're very, very painful. And I could give up and not use them pretty much on a daily basis. But I use them every single day because I push past the pain and realize that I'm just grateful to have the ability to walk again.
You're at Walter Reed. We know that you woke up, you read the thing. Your father is there. This happens. What does your journey look like from there?
A lot of pain. My mind messing with me. I was on approximately 20 medications at one point where they were just like, I had to take pills and liquid painkillers and this and that just constantly. And therapy was excruciating. And I'll never forget, because the doctors told me, look, man, you're not going to be able to even use prosthetics. The burns that you sustained on your legs and the damage done were so bad, you would never walk again. Just get comfortable with your wheelchair. And I was in the hospital for almost a year, and this is all I was hearing constantly. And I was so stubborn. And I'm like, no, I see other people using prosthetics and I know for a fact that I'm going to like start relying on something bigger and better than myself to give me strength and heal me and help me get through this situation, because the painkillers were messing with my mind. So I told my doctor, I'm done with this stuff. I'm doing this my own way. And I went to my therapist and I was like, hey, can I get actually in prosthetics and learn how to walk again? He's like, well, we can try, but you're going to have to do it one at a time because my left femur was still healing. So there was a metal X fixator around my femur on the outside that was screwed into my femur, holding it together and allowing it to heal. So I got in my right leg first for a little bit. And during this time, I was like, it was very painful because within a few steps, to be honest, I'm in the bars where I'm learning how to walk, and my right leg, I feel a sharp pain. And we took the prosthetic off, and sure enough, the doctor was right. I had my burn sites completely shredded off, and I was bleeding out a puddle of blood into my liners in my socket.
Jesus Christ. And
so that, I mean, a lot of people technically would consider that like very devastating and be like, well, what the heck? The doctor was right. So why would I even want to continue this and even try again? Because that was very painful for one. But number two, it looks like the doctor was right. I'm never going to be able to use these things. And I just kept with that. I was like, no, I'm going to heal myself. I continued to heal my right leg. I was able to get back in my right prosthetic. And then my left femur, the doctor said, well, it's all healed. You're good to go. So I got in my left prosthetic. And I kid you not, two steps was all it took in my left leg. I took one step, two step. My femur snaps in half inside my socket, creating a loud popping noise that my therapist at the time, who was like 500 million years old, did not hear the loud pop and actually told me to keep walking.
Whoa.
I was like, no, dude, I'm pretty sure I need to get this thing checked. First, it hurts like a mother. Second, I'm pretty sure it broke, so I should probably go get it looked at. He's like, fine, go get it checked and come back and finish PT. I'm still convinced to this day that guy was a drill sergeant. I'm pretty sure. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, I went into immediate surgery. So all of these things continuously happening that are bad while I'm trying to heal, while I'm trying to move forward with life and actually progress my situation and be able to walk. And it was difficult messing with my mind to the point where some folks don't know, but I was actually married while I was deployed to Afghanistan, and it caused so much strain. And she actually didn't like robots, so she took off. And I say that lightly, but I got divorced. My medications were messing with my mind. And like I said earlier, during my time in therapy and even some of the time in my house in the hospital, I did attempt suicide 12 separate times and it almost took my life. And it was very, very hard. I had to start relying on other things than myself because I couldn't get through it on my own.
Hey guys, if you're enjoying the Street Cop Podcast, do us a favor and give us a review on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you're listening to us. Tell a friend. We don't charge anything for the episodes. We appreciate your support. Check us out on any social platform by putting into the search bar Street Cop Training. Give us a follow. We have a lot of free content coming out every single day that you might not catch here on the podcast. And it's important for you to be able to do your job more professionally. And we also entertain you as well.
This is an interesting question I have. Your ex-wife, the one who left. You know, I heard something recently from a friend of mine who went through a significant cancer scare. And although he wasn't married, not cancer scare, he actually had cancer. It wasn't a scare. So he had cancer, he was going through a lot of difficult times in his life. And, you know, I said, you know, what happened to your girlfriend? Beautiful, beautiful girlfriend. He goes, that she couldn't handle it. I go, what do you mean? He goes, she couldn't handle this, what I was going through, and she left. You know, so when I think about your story, it reminds me of that, because I try to unpack that a little bit, because I've met his girlfriend, and, you know, I'm saying to myself, what was it doing to her that made her have to leave him? Was it selfish? Was it a thing of, you know, she wasn't well and she had to leave, as selfish as it may have been. It might have saved her life. There's a lot of things I think about. What do you think about when you think about why your wife left you in a situation that you were in? Are you angry? Have you made peace with it? Have you tried to understand why it happened?
That's a good question. Honestly, I made peace with it. Literally, at the beginning, I would think about it constantly. Why would you leave in this situation when other warriors that are literally our neighbors in the Fisher House are dealing with the same stuff and their spouse is there? They're giving them like all the help they could possibly have in the situation. And is, I think our age, number one, had to deal with it for sure. Our immaturity levels also. And the lack of faith that we had in, I guess, ourselves, if you will, too. But this situation is not easy for anyone. It takes a big heart. It takes a lot of hard work and focus to be with someone that is, if you want to say, different. But in my situation, it is difficult. My wife now, Crystal, is my caregiver. When we're not on stage, when I'm not out telling my story, singing and doing the things that I do for work and what we enjoy, I'm back home or back here in the motorhome as we travel, and she's taking care of my knees, taking care of me, especially when my legs are off and I'm trying to rest and heal up my, what they call nubs, which are the rest of my legs. It's a lot of work. And so when someone doesn't have the maturity level, the even thought to be like, hey, I want to be by your side no matter what. I mean, technically, when we marry someone, we say death do us till death do us part, right? Well, sadly enough, we really don't mean it when we say it, because our divorce rate wouldn't be so high, would it? But yet it is. It's insanely high. And so we have to mean stuff that we say for us to be able to handle situations that come our way. And when we mean it wholeheartedly, that's when we overcome things. So I was able to leave the negative thoughts about my first marriage back where it belongs in the past, not dwell on it. And it did mess with me mentally, thinking, okay, well, I was thinking, oh, no one's going to love me for me. No one's going to care about me in this situation, so on and so forth. And I heard a pastor say, pray specifics. And I was like, I'm honestly not the one to really do this, but I'll try it anyways. So I prayed to me, my future wife, Crystal, not her specifically, just whoever my future wife was going to be. I want to meet her at the gym. I want her to have curly hair, and I want her to have a relationship with him too. And sure enough, Crystal shows up at the gym that week after I prayed that, in San Antonio, where she lives 5 hours south in Brownsville, Texas. She didn't even need to be in San Antonio, but she was there for a dance audition for the Spurs and ends up meeting me, and we fall in love, and 6 months later, we're married. Then real love, we actually still went through some crap. Like, no marriage is perfect. We almost got divorced our first year, but we had to remind ourselves to never give up on the situation and that we could handle it and just continue to fight for each other. And we're about to celebrate 5 years being married February 22nd.
It's amazing, dude.
Yeah.
You said when we say stuff, we have to mean it. People who know me best know that I do not drop L-bombs. So the word love is very sacred to me. One thing that bothers me, and maybe bothered me in the past, and I'm trying to come from a non-judgmental place, but I would watch people that I know get in relationships. I've seen it here, adults doing it, and telling people in 3 or 5 weeks or 7 weeks of a relationship, hey, I love you. When you use it so frequently, I feel like it dilutes what it means to say that word. Absolutely. Heather Glogalich, that's part of her vernacular. When she gets off the phone with somebody. She's one of our instructors here. She's a lieutenant at the Morris Township Police Department, but she's one of our instructors. She's a really good one at that. And she always says to me, "Hey, I love you." And I always say to her, I'll talk to you later. And she like laughs. And I'm like, it's so sacred to me, man. Like, listen, I'm not saying I don't appreciate you, and I do as a human being, but I have a hard time now on the other side of the token. I literally tell my kids all day long. I just do this all day. Hey, Sal. Yeah, I love you. I love you too, Dad. Frank, Frankie, what? Frank, I love you. I love you too, Dad. I do this all day long. Nice. Right. I do this all. I have four kids. So I just do. It means so much to me that I don't just toss it around. I don't tell people that I love them. I got to be honest with you, as fucked up as it sounds, and in all transparency, I don't tell my parents that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's a very, I just don't have a relationship like that with my parents. And I have a very difficult time saying it to just about anybody besides the people that I really, 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 really feel that unconditional love towards. So, you know, marriage, the institution of it, yeah, I think there are variables, and that's a whole different conversation for a different day. But you're right, man. And I'm proud that you took that oath very seriously because it meant a lot. How did you guys meet in the gym? What was that like?
So if I recall correctly, when I walked into the gym, there was a very bright white light on me and there were doves that flew out from behind. And as soon as she turned and looked at me, she was like,
"Yeah, exactly, dude.
I remember.
Like the song was like, I was dying in your arms tonight. You were walking, the light was behind you, right? Must have been something you said. Your hair was just blowing in the fucking wind.
That's true, but it was a new rendition. It must have been your sexy legs. Yeah, that's what it was.
That's
what it was. It's a remix. But that's funny. So I saw her in the gym. What she was with her cousin Nicole, and they were working out or whatever. And I saw she was on my favorite workout machine. So the cable tricep pull down. So my triceps are my favorite muscle. And I was like, okay, this is my only time that I can actually say something that would make her smile. And so I walked over and I said, "I just want to let you know that you're actually doing this workout way better than most of the dudes in here. Like, most of them don't even know how to properly do this to actually get form in the tricep. I just want to let you know you're doing it amazing." And her cousin Nicole was like, "Oh, it's all her. It's all her." And it was really funny. So we got to talking, traded social media. And then 3 days later, I took her out on a date and found out she wasn't even from, like, living in San Antonio. She was going back home. And that's when I knew that I needed to talk to her dad and change her location. Because she was very special from the very beginning, and I felt that connection immediately. So,
all right, let me go back a little bit here. What are some of the things you live with today in physical discomfort? We know that every amputee we talk to tells us the same thing. The pain of wearing the prosthetics is a real thing. And I'm glad that you guys say this to me and the podcast nation here. Because we don't know that, right? We don't know that. So now there's a lot more. And man, I try to normalize shit. You know what I mean? Like, I don't try to like treat you differently. I've been given a lot of credit from friends of mine that are bound to wheelchairs, do look different. You make it very easy for me. So I'm kind of pride myself, but I'm also kind of like, that's just who I am. And I'm a ball breaker. So I don't care what the fuck you look like. I'm going to break your goddamn balls. But you know, what other discomforts are you currently living with today? And, you know, when you say earlier, like, "Oh, it was a lot of pain, intense pain," people don't understand what that means. They don't know what intense pain is. You have no fucking idea what this dude went through. And I really try to empathize and imagine the worst pain of my life and living that way for quite a long time, I'd imagine. Is that correct?
Yeah. So just to give you an idea of some of the pain that I went through, I'm talking laying in the bed in the hospital bed. I will absolutely never forget literal nights of screaming, crying my eyes out to the point where I would pass out and fall asleep because the pain was so bad. They legally maxed me out on the amount of painkillers they were allowed to inject in my body, and it didn't even touch the pain at all. I'll never forget my family members having to leave the hospital room because when they had to clean me, they would tilt me onto my side. And if you recall, my pelvis snapped in half, my spine dislocated from my pelvis.
Shit, dude.
So just moving my body at all was excruciating. So they would tilt me onto my side and have to wipe me down and clean me and everything, put me back on my backside, tilt me to the other side, make sure they got every literal ounce of body that was needed to be cleaned up. But I would scream bloody murder the entire time. It was excruciating. And I know that the nurses never enjoyed doing that because they knew we were in pain. They knew I was in pain. But they needed to do it because we had to be clean. So I'm grateful for those moments so that my body didn't deteriorate in disgusting filth, because even though it was painful, they had to do it. And on top of that, to this day, some amputees will deal with fibromyalgia, which is nerve pain, like myself. Some will deal with phantom pain, which thankfully I no longer have to deal with anymore, which was really nice. That went away. But the nerve pain is not fun. It literally, I can tell you, I'm the best weatherman in any city that I go to, because I will tell you when a storm is coming, because the barometric pressure in the air drops and it lights up my nerves, sending electric shocks down my legs that range from, okay, this is annoying, to punching my legs, the pain is so bad, to keeping me up all night, 48 hours straight, and literally forcing me to go to the hospital to get a quick shot to stop the nerves from firing up. It is not fun to deal with. And yes, there are medications to take to calm it, if you will, but I'm not on any of those medications. I'm on zero medications, actually, because I know that I'm able to handle what I'm going through. So,
goddamn. What else are you dealing with currently besides those things? And I'm not trying to devalue the significance of dealing with a situation like that.
Aside from that, I would say the short-term memory issues don't necessarily help. It actually stops me from learning things that I would like to, or even going back to school for certain things. Now, if I'm super passionate about something, it will stick. Prime example, I can actually learn a song, play guitar, sing a song, and learn it before I even go to bed. But other things, for whatever reason, don't actually stick. And then one of the things that actually happened that wasn't even, I'll say this just because it deals with pain. It happened in basic training where at Fort Leonard Wood at the time, there was a, how do I say this? Meningitis was kind of a thing that was spreading that was actually, it's very deadly meningitis. And it has the same symptoms as the flu. So anyone who had any symptoms at all would go get a spinal tap and get tested for meningitis just to make sure everyone was good. I had the flu symptoms. They brought me to the room where they would do the spinal tap. And the person who was practicing on me wasn't able to get it in the spine to draw out the fluids. So the doctor comes in and he actually pushes a little too hard, hitting my spinal cord and shooting electric shock straight through the bottom of my legs, shooting me off of the table, the examination table, with the needle still in my back. So the doctor was like, okay, you need to slowly get back onto the examination table. Do not hit the table with your back or the needle, and no sudden movements. It could possibly paralyze you. So I did that. He quickly got the needle out after drawing some of the spinal fluid, and I did not have meningitis. I was okay. But he said, we apologize, because at this moment you're actually going to be dealing with migraines on a monthly basis, regular basis for the rest of your life.
Holy fuck, dude.
Sweet. So migraines are not fun. They could actually get a little out of hand from time to time, but it's all good. Excedrin is a very nice thing.
God damn it, dude.
From time to time.
12 attempts at your life.
Yeah, it's been crazy. That's for sure.
What were those like? Walk me through some of those.
The 12 attempts?
Yeah.
Every single one of them filled with questions of why should I stick around? Why do I even need to be here? Because I'm literally a half a dude. Don't have legs. No one's going to love me. No one's going to want to take care of me. I'm not even going to get to enjoy life the way I used to when I had legs. And so I literally had my 9mm ready to go, drawn in my mouth. I've had daggers, like real blades, ready to do through the heart and through the spine. And then the most attempts was actually taking medications, painkillers to try and overdose. And none of those moments, nobody knew about one of them. And when I actually opened up and told my dad, finally, after all these years, I told him, I was like, hey, I just want to let you know I'm sorry, but I tried attempting suicide and almost took my life so many times, and I never told you once. And he had a hard time with that, but I think it opened my eyes to realize that there are other people that are in those situations where whatever they may be going through, it's drawing their mindset to want to get to that point, and it's not worth it. Because what I learned after those 12 attempts, and I'm so grateful I never took my life, is the fact that we can handle life together. It takes one phone call to open up and be like, hey, you're my best friend, you're my parent, you're my sibling, whatever, you're somebody I trust that would tell me the truth and help me get through a difficult time in life, and I'm seriously sucking at life right now. I need to tell you what's going on. And that was an eye-opener for me, that when I actually spoke up and had the guts to freaking be like, hey, I'm not okay, and I hate my freaking life right now, and I'm ready to end it. When I opened up, all the weight that I was carrying by myself got spread out to all of the people that I told and allowed them to help build me back up, if you will, help encourage me, even though they didn't understand my situation. That was one of my professional, like, tell people, look, you don't know what I'm going through, so just, you can shut up and not tell me anything because you can't relate. You have no clue what I'm going through. But after I let my pride go and realized it didn't matter if they didn't understand, what mattered is the fact that they actually cared enough to stick around and be there and encourage me, like others did not. So those people that wanted to stick around, that wanted to encourage me, they helped get me through a lot of the dark moments in my life. But people asked, those 12 specific moments was 100% my faith getting me through, reminding me, just giving me the positive thoughts that literally say, hey, you still have a purpose here in life, and I will give you the strength to get through it and overcome all things that you face. And I didn't take my life. And I'm extremely grateful that I did not, because so many positive things came through all of those negatives and all of that pain and all of the suffering. And I met my wife. She helped me literally take off my prosthetic and beat me with it till I wrote my story in a book, which was awesome. She doesn't like that joke, but I think it's hilarious, because that's about as stubborn as I am. You need to pretty much hit me with my own legs to get me to do something that I don't want to do. But she quit her job and she set up my first speaking engagement like full-time speaking engagement, and they kicked off ever since. I've been doing that all over the globe for all sorts of corporations and businesses, schools. We've even gone to prisons. We've done it for the military branches. That none of that would have happened if I gave into those thoughts and didn't allow somebody to step in and say, hey, I don't know your situation or what you're actually going through, but I am going to be here to help get you through. And here we are today.
So what's your purpose now?
My purpose is to remind people to never give up, never surrender. No matter what they face, no matter what they're going through, no matter how painful it is, just tell that negative thing, that tragedy that is trying to take you out, trying to bring you down, look at it in the face and say, nice try. You're not going to take me out. I have a life to live and I'm going to live it the best I possibly can. You guys can't see the other side of this shirt. It says no legs, no problem. On the back, it says, what's your excuse? There's other people that are in worse situations than me, living life to the fullest, not giving up. Even though it's painful, even though it's difficult, we still keep pushing forward. So if we can do it, what's stopping you? That's my purpose.
Ooh, that was one fucking hell of a message. Christ, I was like, fuck, dude, I couldn't ask for a better fucking thing for you to say. We're from Jersey, we curse. I'm sorry, dude. It is what it is.
Accent straight up Jersey.
That's awesome. There's nothing I can do about that. You probably caught on to that when you met me because, one, I was jet lagged. I was exhausted. And I am very Jersey and very, you know, loud and whatever. I was thrilled to meet you guys. I don't know what you thought of me when you met me. You're probably like, who the fuck is this guy?
No, actually, that's funny you say that. Crystal and I were like, this dude's cool. I hope, like, he's legit and we actually link up and talk. So it's cool that we're here. Thank you for having me. Thank you for actually being a cool, down-to-earth guy and legit. That's awesome.
Dude, I hope that we can, you know, in my whole heart, I am a busy guy. You're a busy guy. I hope that we can stay in touch and have a friendship through this thing. And, you know, hopefully get together on some shit in the future. And I don't want to say that with like empty promises and like blowing smoke up your ass. I preface saying that with like, yo, I'm fucking busy as fuck, but don't think I'll ever forget you. And anything you need, you can call on me. You'll probably call on me before I call on you, but don't be surprised if you hear from me in the future. And dude, if you come to fucking Jersey, like you better come and visit us.
Yeah,
in the office. The fucking setup here is legit.
For sure. Yeah, it looks sick, dude. You got a really nice thing going on over there for sure. I'm over here sitting in an RV trying to make it look nice.
No, it looks great, dude. It's a cool ass RV. I had an RV for a very brief period of time, 9 months, and I sold it. And of course, to the ridicule of my wife, she's like, there's another thing. You got impulsive, you got obsessive, you bought this fucking thing and now it's gone. And the reality is like, that's kind of how I live my life. But if I didn't buy it, I wouldn't have found out that it's not what I thought it was going to be for me. That's and true. In my mind, I would have always wondered it. And of course, I'm quickly criticized now because I'm talking about getting my pilot's license. And now people are like, dude, we fucking love you so much. Can you please reconsider this? And I'm like, no. See? And then like, it's like, oh, you're going to go fucking buy a plane now? And I'm like, yeah, probably. Right. But like, all I needed to do is work out, dude. Like, let's not forget about the fucking 94% of things that I put my hands on that end up being fucking magical. So yeah, I fuck up. Like, what are you going to do, man? But the RV, maybe you can speak to this, JP. Oh, they're a pain in the ass to take care of, aren't they?
Yeah, I'm working on it constantly. But the thing is, this is one of the ways that we travel on tour. So
sure,
it's fun because I get to have all of our stuff in here.
Right.
I have my guitar, my prosthetics, all of the stuff. So we always have all of our gear with us, but I'm the only driver because it's adapted. So she can't drive it.
Oh,
so
God.
I drive 24/7 and it's a lot of driving. So we'll see. I think we're going to fly a little bit more this year. But last year, the last almost 2 years has been approximately 80,000 miles within driving the motorhome and my Jeep all across the U.S.
Bro, you got to come get your pilot's license with me. We'll fuck around and find out. You know what I'm saying? I don't think you need feet for a pilot's license. You can fly a plane without feet, right?
Yes. So the rudders are operated with just a little adaptive joystick type thing. But when you're flying in the air, it's all hand controls. So I'm already used to hand controls. And that's actually the next, I've not told anybody this besides my wife. I actually want to get my pilot's license. And if I can save up, I want to do it and start the process on May 30th, which is my birthday. That'd be cool.
Man, this was fucking amazing. Dude, tell us about the book. Tell us where we can find you.
I would love to, definitely. So I've had a lot of my buddies, my soldiers, brothers and sisters in arms actually read my book, and it's really cool to get their feedback on it because they were so happy they read it, because they didn't know a lot of the details. Even after I've told my story to people, they actually were so honored after reading what my entire family went through, because I actually purposefully wrote all the different things that not only I went through, but for example, my stepmom, who I call my mom, and my dad, they were going through a difficult time. My mom, just to give you the very quick version, I won't give every detail, but she had lymphoma, and then that was stage 4 cancer. And the day she was announced free of that cancer, they were driving home. And that same time, that same drive, my dad gets a call from command in Afghanistan: your son is on his deathbed.
Holy shit.
So literally.
Maybe we should do this again, dude, because there's a lot of stuff to unpack here. Maybe we should call this part 1 and go into part 2, because there's a lot of good shit there.
Yeah. So I wrote all of it in my book. It's a very quick read too. I don't know if you can, it's not a very big book. It's a 6-hour read. And walking again, I kept it simple, and it was hilarious because during the time that I was writing it, I was talking to a lot of my Marine buddies. Even though I'm Army, we love everybody, right? So it's hilarious because they asked me, are you going to have pictures? I'm like, bro, guys, don't worry. I'll put pictures. There's no crayons provided. There's no coloring. It's not a coloring book, but it will be pictures. So, all the pictures are in there. It's a great read, and they can find it on Amazon. Just look, Walking Again, JP Lane. Also, all of my social media is JP Lane Official. And definitely, if people want to continue to follow our journey, Crystal and I just started Life with the Lanes on YouTube. So we're cool. Super excited about that too. So
you got to get on TikTok, dude. Let's get you fucking.
I am on TikTok. I have almost 900,000 followers on TikTok.
That's JP right. We Lane talked about that, because you said to me, no, we're good on TikTok, but our fucking something else. I think you said your Instagram is weak as fuck.
Yeah, we were slacking on everything else.
Yeah, that's good, dude. And bro, please, if your itinerary is New Jersey, you gotta text me. We gotta set something up, and I'll bring you to a place to eat, or places to eat that'll blow your fucking mind. Like, you'll just be thankful that you get to meet me.
Do you like lobster?
Brother, I like everything.
Cool, down. We're good.
I hope that we can do something in the future. I think we will. Let's get part 2 scheduled with Frankie. And please make sure you have my cell phone number. I know you passed me off to your wife last time, like I was an ugly chick at a bar. Right. And she was taking the fucking grenade. But like, dude, he's going to send you my cell phone number. Text me. And that's anything I can do for you, bro, keep it in touch. We have a lot of following, and we want to help you out. And I got things in mind for the future for you to show up. And I hopefully you could be a little bit of a guest here on the show. And I have a funny fucking feeling people are going to see me and go, that JP Lane one was fucking good, dude. And I'm going to go, yeah, I knew it. Listen, bro, it was good. Shit was legit today, bro. I mean, typically, an hour. I'm already getting yelled at by my staff. We have a company meeting in 18 minutes. And they're like, I'm literally getting texted like, hey, fuckhead, do you realize how much shit we have to do before 3 o'clock hits? So nice. Anyway, brother, thank you for being here, bro. And I'll talk to you soon. And dude, you're the best.
I appreciate it, bro. Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad we ran into each other at the SHOT Show, and definitely looking forward to linking up and hanging out and doing some more stuff together for sure. So thank you so much.
Sweet, dude. I got a fucking phone call coming. I got to answer this one. Oh, shit. She hung up. Dude, I'll see you, bro. Like, anything you need, reach out. We'll help you out.
Roger that. Appreciate it. Bye, Crystal. Bro. Take care.
Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com.
You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer.